Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical discussion, debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your emails and calls. It's all here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We had a lot of interesting bits of news, some discoveries, some basic science stuff. It's kind of fun, and a new drug for depression. So we're going to start off this week by reviewing some of that news. First of all, you know, it's kind of a law of unintended consequences, but I have to comment that the Bush-era prohibition on embryonic stem cell research actually forced a lot of people into the harder search for stem cells in adult tissue, and that has paid off. We are finding all sorts of stem cells all over the place. The latest, published in Thursday's issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, is a stem cell in the lung. Now, if this pans out, this has great implications, because one of our problems with stem cells is those omnipotential cells that can turn into anything. Well, how do we tell them what to turn into? So if we can find stem cells that are already semi-committed to being a certain tissue, for example, this is a lung stem cell. It's been committed to be a lung cell, so it's going to be great for repairing and patching lung tissue. Maybe we'll get to the point where we can regrow healthy alveoli in people with emphysema. That would be a real holy grail in terms of the healthcare of the population. Maybe we can get to the point where we can really do serious lung repair in people whose lungs are damaged from various sorts of illnesses and exposures. So it's all very new, but extremely cool. And it does look like, in mice at least, these human lung stem cells do actually turn into lungs. They're rebuilding airways, air sacs, and blood vessels in lungs that have been experimentally damaged. Now, that's human cells into mice, not human cells into humans, but it's pretty interesting. Turns out those little cells are machines. They're pre-programmed, and if you can get them into the right place, sometimes they just know what to do. Another interesting story this week is a finding that a drug that already has been approved by the FDA, that is a melatonin receptor binder, is possibly going to be a new treatment for depression. This study, published in Lancet May 17th, looks at a drug from an Australian group. Ian Hickey, the lead professor at the University of Sydney, was the chief author on this, and Professor Naomi Rogers from Central Queensland University. What they found was that the drug, whose trade name is Melaton, let me give you the generic name, that's what you should Google, is agomelatine, A-G-O-M-E-L-A-T-I-N-E. This improves moods, helps people sleep better, and has fewer side effects than traditional antidepressants. It fixes the circadian rhythm. And one of the things that happens in depression is that waking up in the middle of the night, not being able to get back to sleep, that's a classic circadian rhythm disruption. The other large population group that suffers from that, by the way, is women going through menopause. And in both cases, with the disruption of the circadian rhythm comes a host of ill effects on the brain, mental fog, energy issues, and all of the sorts of things that you'd expect when you systematically sleep deprive someone. Well, it turns out depression isn't just a Prozac deficiency. It's actually a systemic disruption that includes issues around serotonin, but also issues around melatonin. So who knows whether this will pan out in the long term. This is a short-term study, ran about 6 months. In the long term, that is to say in 6 months, the people who took the agomelatine had a improvement in their depression and fewer relapses of depression. So maybe what this is going to be is a relapse prevention drug as well as an antidepressant. What about long-term use in a new drug that we've only limited experience with? Well, one possibility, we could get receptor down regulation. In other words, if you keep hitting a receptor with an artificial chemical, sometimes the body will downregulate that receptor, in other words, start making less of it, and that could lead to long-term dependency issues for this agent. So I'm not suggesting everybody run out and do this. And just to clarify what I meant by the Prozac deficiency, I think that we have a mindset in our society that any disease is actually, or some diseases like depression, perhaps hypertension isn't just a deficiency of antihypertensive medications. Perhaps hyperlipidemia isn't just a Lipitor deficiency, but we frame it that way. Oh, you have this disease, take this drug. That's not always the smartest way to go, but it's the easiest way, and it is definitely the way that is incentivized in our culture. And more about incentives later on in the program. Let's talk about this final little bit of news before we take a break, and that is looking at DNA methylation. Here's the setup. We know that children whose mothers smoked while they were pregnant have a higher rate of asthma, even if they quit smoking during pregnancy and there's a non-smoking household once the baby is born. So knowing that, researchers have been trying to figure out what's going on. And using a fairly practical and easy to do study, researchers looked at methylation changes in the DNA of children, and they compared that to the mothers. And the idea being that if you have the nicotine or the tar or whatever it is that's doing the effect on the baby that creates the asthma in the bloodstream, basically, while the baby is being formed in the uterus, it's going to get this into its body. That's going to change the DNA. And the researchers identified a specific gene that's called AXL, which is highly methylated in the children who were exposed to in utero cigarette smoke and not in the children whose grandmothers were smoking, which we would assume would create household exposure. So methylation changes predispose these children to asthma. And even if there's no smoking in the household, it still creates problems. We also know that smoking during pregnancy creates low birth weight, and smaller babies have higher infant mortality rates. Now to go to some emails. This from Bella, and I'm not sure where Bella's from. I'm expecting to travel to North Africa next month. I've never flown overseas before. I'm coming up on 70, long-time asthmatic, somewhat arthritic, but otherwise in pretty good health with energy. I will be in a group traveling around Morocco for several weeks. Any guidelines for going to that part of the planet, particularly for long overseas flights? Are there any inoculations necessary for that country, and should I get a checkup? Outside of the obvious concern of the effects on my lungs of cigarette smoke and smogs in the cities, and of dust and heat in general, are there other things I should prepare for or be aware of? Are probiotics useful as a preventative measure against intestinal problems? Well, I'll take that last question first before I launch into my little essay here on travel over 50. But yes, I think that probiotics are extremely useful for prevention of intestinal problems. I recommend you take a large supply. And for just prevention, perhaps 20 billion organisms twice a day. Should you get a diarrheal illness, going up to doses of 60, 70, even 80 billion organisms three times a day can really shut down a diarrhea. That being said, because of the problems of dysentery and hemolytic E. coli in North Africa, I do recommend taking an appropriate antibiotic with you for traveler's diarrhea treatment should you become ill while in country. I've had a number of friends and patients travel to North Africa and really get so sick. Then there are definitely moments when antibiotics are called for. For example, if you see mucus or blood in that diarrhea. Now let's talk a little bit about air travel. And I call this air travel after 50 because after the age of 50, people gradually develop an increased thrombophilia. In other words, a tendency for their blood to want to clot. This can be a very bad thing when you're on a long airplane flight. Now, studies from surgery patients tell us that when you lie still and there's no movement of your body for, say, 6 or 7 hours, you will form clots in the large veins in your pelvis and legs. In the case of a surgery patient, they are at risk for pulmonary embolism, in other words, a clot breaking off and going to the lung for the immediate post-op period. And nowadays, we often use active pumps on their legs or clot-busting drugs like heparin to lower the risk of that person getting a blood clot. But of course, you can't stop blood clotting while you're cutting on the person. You have to wait till the blood clots and then start your anti-DVT prophylaxis. On an airplane, the same thing can happen. And the fact that you're at altitude, roughly the equivalent of 8,000 feet, gives you a risk. What can you do about that risk? Well, taking an aspirin before you get on the airplane is a good idea. And just one regular strength aspirin. Don't do this if you have ulcers. But if you don't, that's something that lowers the chances of clotting. Wearing support garments, so support hose, at least knee-high stockings that provide support and compression and prevent the blood from being able to pool in those legs, because unfortunately on an airplane, your legs are downhill from your heart. Getting up every 2 to 3 hours and walking is extremely useful. If you can't get up and walk, pumping your legs up and down, pointing the toes, pulling the toes up, doing that, say, 20 or 30 times, bicycling motions in the seat. Yes, of course, the person next to you is going to think you're crazy, but hey, you know, you can smile at them and give them a cookie or something afterwards. But do move your body. Other issues that to be thought of are, of course, not getting sick on the airplane. And that's where using a hand sanitizer, as soon as you get seated and you've buckled yourself in, remember that the tray table in front of you is probably contaminated. So once you pull that down for the in-flight meal, assuming you get an in-flight meal, clean your hands again. Squirting salt water in your nose and blowing it back out again every couple of hours helps maintain a level of moisture in the nose that allows virus particles to be washed out naturally by your mucous cilia, which are these little hair cells that beat and, well, essentially send viruses down into your stomach from your nose. You want to keep that area moist so that that movement occurs. I always recommend bringing a mask with you on the airplane, and this is for you to use if the person next to you is coughing their head up. If you're sitting next to an obviously sick person on an airplane, you really don't have an option on a crowded flight but to protect yourself. So smile again, give them a cookie. And when I say give them a cookie, I'm saying be kind to them, be nice, explain what you're doing so that they don't feel insulted and maybe get retaliatory. But put that mask on and protect yourself against the viruses that are infusing the air around you. You can't run and you can't hide, but you can protect yourself. Bring snacks for the airplane. The stuff that they serve you is high in sodium, high in preservatives, and remember finger foods, hand sanitizer. When you travel, be sure that you carry your medications with you on the airplane. Do not pack that in your luggage. If your luggage and you get separated, you might be without your meds for days before you can get copies faxed from the United States and find a pharmacy that will honor them. Copies of your prescriptions in your luggage is a good idea. You can get copies of your prescriptions from your doctors. You can take that if you do need to get a week's supply of something because your pills are mislaid during your voyage. Your inhaler is mislaid during your voyage. You can get that or something similar from a pharmacy in the country you're in. And those are just basic precautions that you need to take, along with a copy of your passport while you're at it. If you have a bladder issue, continence issues, consider wearing an adult diaper on the flight. There have been moments since 9-1-1 in this country when I have been traveling when I dearly wished I was wearing a Depends because we're on security lockdown and no one can leave their seats. As far as advanced planning is concerned, go to the CDC website where the advice for travelers by region is excellent. Look at your itinerary, including the stopovers on your air flight. If the plane is going to be landing and refueling in a country where there's yellow fever, you want to get the yellow fever vaccine. Because if you even land in a country that has yellow fever, you may have difficulty getting out of quarantine in the next country that doesn't want to have yellow fever. And that has happened to several of my more adventurous travelers in Africa. Consider typhoid, which is salmonella. That's a poop-to-mouth disease. Also hepatitis A, both very common in North Africa and therefore an issue to think about. getting yourself protected against poop-to-mouth diseases. And that CDC site will give you other advice, certain other vaccines. It's all by area. It's all by what's going on right now. In some parts of Southeast Asia, you should do polio vaccine. In some parts of North Africa, notably Saudi Arabia, one could consider meningitis, particularly for the Hajj, because they do have meningitis outbreaks periodically during the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage. So let me see. Have I covered it? Most of it. And I'm sure I've left something out, but that's what makes it fun. Call me and let me know what I've forgotten. We had an off-air comment about water purification, and that's true. I didn't talk about that on my travel. So you see, I told you, I knew I would forget things. Asking, do I prefer ultraviolet devices or pump and filter for purifying water when traveling? Also, when you're worried about water, should you avoid salads or fruit or anything uncooked? And what about sliced fruit? So the standard advice is if you don't know that it's been washed with distilled water, then you have to be concerned about food. You can wash it yourself in distilled water, but that gets expensive when you're traveling. One strategy I've used to use was I would take iodine tablets with me. And once I got to the country in question, I would acquire a water container, largest, you know, 2 or 3 liter plastic water bottle. Then I would fill that with tap water and put a couple of iodine tablets in it and let that sit overnight, following the instructions on the package. And that would give me iodine water that I could use to wash things, wash food that I'd purchased at markets and stalls and stuff. And of course, you want to wash peeled foods. Salads, I pretty much just avoid when I'm in a country where there's a lot of foodborne illness. There's just a lot of things out there commercially that will purify water. It depends on where you're going and what the availability would be. I'm still a little skeptical about the ultraviolets, and I haven't seen good studies, but I haven't really looked. And so I'll kind of say I'm on the fence on the ultraviolet devices. I bought one and haven't used it. I sort of have preferred to use the filter and then, you know, basically put things through a filter or hit it with iodine and then run it through a charcoal filter to get rid of the iodine taste. And those have been the methods that I feel the most comfortable with. But, you know, I don't want to diss the UV devices. I'm going to just say neutral, more information needed before I start advocating them, however. We're going now to Drew in Felton. Hello, Drew, and welcome to the program. Hi.
I wanted to go back and talk to you a little bit about methylation of DNA, but you missed malaria.
I missed malaria because it depends on the season and whether you're going to be in wet areas. And so that's why I'm sending them to the CDC website for that.
Okay. Anyway, one of the things I was curious if you had seen anything, I had read an article recently on the grandmother's societal habits, drinking and smoking, effect on her grandchildren, since those ova are going through preliminary meiosis inside the fetus of...
And that indeed does happen. It's the maternal grandmothers only, obviously, because the fetuses that become the daughters, which then become the mothers of the grandchildren, is how that gets translated. And yes, indeed, there is good evidence for all sorts of things, stress even, starvation, and alcohol. And that's probably what fetal alcohol syndrome is, actually, is methylation changes related to the presence of alcohol in the body causing major methylation shifts. Although, as far as I know, that hasn't been mapped at this point. Your point about grandmothers is very well taken.
Thank you very much. You have a good day, and I'll see you soon.
I'll see you soon. Bye-bye. And that was one of my medical colleagues, so I always love it when one of my colleagues calls in. Let's go to Peter in Monterey. Hello, Peter. You had a suggestion for us.
Yeah. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
This is just a travel suggestion. I log a lot of miles every year nationally and internationally. And you were talking about prescriptions, hard copy in your suitcase. And then I think the other person on the mic mentioned your passport. So this is what you do. You photocopy your credit cards, both sides of your credit cards. You photocopy your passport. You photocopy any of your prescriptions, and then you save them as a Word doc or a PDF, and then you keep them stored in your email, so no matter where you are in the world, separated from your luggage, day to day, anywhere in the world, you can access the monitor, and therefore access your email. The you're covered.
Isn't there an issue with security putting your...
Not at all. Not with email. I think when we hear about security breaches and things like that, we've never heard, for example, of a Gmail or Yahoo security breach that I'm aware of. Hotmail is sketchy, but I don't want to take sides on which, you know, email client to use. Now, you can also use an encryption program. There's free downloadable encryption programs. I do that, but, you know, you got to ask yourself, if you have your prescriptions in your luggage and it's lost, what's the security breach there?
Yeah, good point.
You know, and if you get your, and if you're, you know, your passport stolen, what's your security breach there? What we're talking about is being stranded somewhere internationally without having any reference to these documents. So anyway, you know, take it for what it's worth. It works for me.
Peter, I think it's a great idea, and I appreciate your calling in with such a valuable suggestion.
All right. Hey, have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our next email is from Spain. Inez in Spain writes, I'm going to skip some of the nice things that she says. I'm the Spanish girl who got in touch with you some weeks ago about piriformis syndrome. Thanks for that, and that was very helpful. I heard you talking about how risky it could be to take proton pump inhibitors for a long time. I've been taking them for years without any advice from a doctor. That's what happens with OTC drugs, Dr. Don parenthetically says. Now I heard you and I read about that. I'd like to stop them. How do I do it? Do you have a link in your website about that? And yes, indeed, under resources, you will find a link on how to get off proton pump inhibitors. So that's the AskDrDawn.com website. And this is a protocol that is a complete, non-scientifically validated, empirical, seat-of-the-pants, I'm a doctor, I can make up stuff, try it, and if it works for my patients, tell you about it kind of protocol. So I want to emphasize that the level of evidence here on a, what do we call it, evidence-based medicine, it's all empirical and anecdotal. But so far it's been working. The concept is that you start adding in pepsin, hydrochloric acid, with your meals. And you do that as you eat so that you get good gastric emptying. And you begin using things that coat your esophagus. And gradually you start switching from your proton pump inhibitor to a less strong acid inhibitor. Step down therapy, in other words. I usually use ranitidine or cimetidine and have the patients take that at night. The person also needs to be very careful to have good habits as far as heartburn is concerned, and that means not lying down for 2 hours after eating, not drinking a lot of water, particularly carbonated water, around meals, and there's a whole list of suggestions about reflux, again, in the resources section on my website. Once you have followed those sorts of instructions, and you've gotten stepped down to the H2 blocker off the proton pump inhibitor, so that's the cimetidine and the ranitidine, then you stay with that, using the hydrochloric acid before meals, using the acid blocker at night for several months. And then you stop using the acid blocker at night, keep using the hydrochloric acid with meals, and see how it goes. Most people take 2 to 3 months to get off of a proton pump inhibitor if they've been on it for several years. It's a rare person who can just stop without having a lot of rebound symptoms. Other natural things that I'll sometimes have people use, there's something called deglycerized licorice, and this coats the inside of the esophagus, makes it a little less vulnerable to hyperacidity, and that can be really useful if you're having trouble following the plan. The next question, Inez writes, another question, do you ever talk about wheat related to bowel discomforts or allergies? You must mean it's because of the gluten stuff, or do you mean it's just the wheat itself? I do not eat much wheat, and when I do, it's always whole grain, but I do eat a lot of barley and rye. Should I stop or reduce them if I have an upset intestine? And the answer to that is that in the United States, Inez, the agricultural business, if you will, is run by a couple of very large corporations which have really standardized the wheat, and the taste of the American public being what it is, they've bred the wheat to have high levels of something called gluten. People that I know as patients who are gluten sensitive, documented gluten sensitive, have told me that when they travel to Europe, they're able to eat the bread and they don't get their reaction. So possibly already there's less gluten or in the bread that you're eating. But that being said, if a person thinks they're gluten sensitive, they need to stop all grains containing gluten and also foods like soy sauce that may have gluten in them. and do that for about a month and track their symptoms of gastric irritability. And if they see an improvement with that, then they should re-challenge one grain at a time. So you said you eat a lot of barley, re-challenge with the barley, do that for about a week, and track your symptoms. If they start coming back, then yes, you're probably sensitive to a component in barley, and that adds data to the idea that it might be gluten sensitivity, since you've already mentioned that you think wheat might be an issue. I don't like to use the word allergies. I've trained myself to say food sensitivity so that I don't make my allergy colleagues angry, because an allergy in medical speak is something that is IgE, immunoglobulin E mediated, and we're not talking about that kind of a reaction. So I hope that clarifies it for you a little bit. We're going to go to our next caller, who is Caroline in Boulder Creek. Hello, Caroline, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have a question because I find myself being drawn into being a caregiver for an elderly friend. As I'm confronting the challenges that go along with that, I'm thinking that it would be a good idea for me to connect up with some kind of a caregiver support group. The problem is I started researching online a little bit, and the only support groups that I could find in this area seem to be specifically focused on caregivers for either Alzheimer's patients or stroke patients. And that's not my situation. My friend is just very elderly, somewhat cranky, but doesn't have Alzheimer's. And so I wonder if you can suggest how I could find a support group for other people in my situation.
Well, let me first of all say that anyone who's listening to Caroline who has a suggestion for her, she's lives in Boulder Creek, so any local people who have any thoughts, please call us in. I don't know that it's easy to tell the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia, but I'm assuming that your friend's issue is frailty rather than memory and confusion issues. Is that correct?
That's correct. Frailty, he has a number of, you know, age-related illnesses of, you know, heart failure, diabetes, things like that.
Right, right. Okay. So what are the questions that you're finding yourself confronting here? Is it more like, how do I emotionally deal with this and not get resentful and angry and not get, you know, swallowed whole by the task? Is that the sort of thing that you're dealing with?
That's a part of it, although I actually already have a support network that can help me with that. But mm-hmm. I would also like to talk with other people about things, you know, more basic, like how do you just coordinate rides to the doctor? You know, what are procedures for helping the person figure out how to get different services through Medicare?
Got it. Okay, I see. So it's more the social work coordination piece of that.
Correct.
Right. The local Alzheimer's Society would probably have a lot of information for you. There's an organization locally called Elder Day, which has like a social worker case coordinator, and she would be able to, he or she, I shouldn't assume, would be able to give you some practical advice in terms of arranging rides and what are the local community resources. The social worker department at Dominican Hospital, which is our local hospital, will talk to you if you call and ask to speak with a social worker and you're just looking for resource information. You can get a lot of information from them that will get you started.
Okay.
And that's local, because this is lore. This is local stuff. Nobody is going to bother to put that on the web. You would be hard put to find instructions on how to flush a toilet on the internet. Maybe you could find it, but it wouldn't come up at the top of a Google search. They're just some things that we assume people know how to do. So the internet isn't always the best source, even though I know that the younger generation thinks it's like, that's it. If it's not on the internet, it doesn't exist. Let me just say that there's a great deal out there that hasn't made it onto the internet. And I hope that all of that real good stuff doesn't get lost, and that we treasure the fact that asking someone who's doing the work for tips and tricks of the trade is still the best way to get this kind of information. Let's see. Someone just called in and said allianceonaging.org. So that's a website to look at. That's in Monterey, but they probably have some information that might be useful for you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to do just a little independent push here. I'm sure the station will forgive me, but I want to ask you for a donation. This is off the schedule, but we have a matching federal grant to replace our equipment, and it finishes up in June. So if we get our grant money, we can get up to $150,000. We need $75,000 from the community, and they'll match whatever we get up to that amount. So we really need to ask for an extra donation so that we can apply it to that. I struggle with the technology here all the time. It's old technology, and we really need to rework it and acquire new equipment. The station needs your help, and I think we're doing a fantastic job with a very, very old car. Reminds me of those folks in Cuba, you know, who've got the 57 Chevys still running. But, you know, that is actually how it feels. And so before any more buttons fall off or light bulbs go out, if you could kick us $5 or $10 for new equipment, KUSP.org/upgrade2011 will get you to the website that will allow you to donate. Thank you. Now, there's been a lot of news this week around healthcare politics. Of course, the back and forth about Medicare vouchers. It's just fun to sit back and watch that thing play out. You know, it's enough said on the whole topic. But here's a couple of other things. A recent study, this was a 2007 study, actually, and I reported it back then, showed that using intensive drug therapy in patients with chest pain worked just as well as angioplasty and stents in preventing heart attacks, improving survival, and relieving discomfort. Well, that was 4 years ago, and guess what? The rate of stenting and angioplasty hasn't shifted, and people have not adopted the drug therapy. It hasn't changed at all. Now, why is that? Incentives. Too many people get cancer tests, another study from the news this week. Older Americans, people with Medicare, mind you, not people with other types of insurance, are getting colonoscopies less than 7 years after getting previous colonoscopies. It's supposed to be every 10 years, starting at the age of 50. But in patients over 80, one-third of them had a repeat exam within 7 years of the previous colonoscopies. You know, it's even debatable whether you benefit from colonoscopy after the age of 80 in terms of whether or not your cancer has enough, if you get one, has enough juice to kill you before something else kills you. So why are we looking for diseases where we're not going to affect outcome? It's a very, very big question. And the answer, again, is incentives. Now, recently, the Obama administration finally produced the regulations that they were proposing for accountable care organizations. And this is one of the cornerstones of the Obama Healthcare Finance Reform Initiative. It would create these entities of doctors and hospital alliances that would be responsible for care of a population. And the concept is that you would take on the care of this population and all of their costs, but all of their benefits would accrue to you. So if you took good care of people, practiced good preventative medicine, the idea is that you would be benefited as an entity. But the regulations are very dense and very complicated. This is an attempt to fix the perverse incentives. The stories I just read you underscore the current perverse incentives. If there's higher reimbursement for procedures, that's going to lead to more procedures. Anytime you have a gray zone decision, it's going to go to the direction that is rewarded. There were psychology studies done in the 70s looking at that, where they studied people in a box and they basically put them in a dark room and said, when you see a light, hit this button. And then they rewarded them differently. Very dark. They were actually trying to see whether you could perceive one photon or not with your retina. Turns out you can. In these very dark rooms, if you were rewarded, if every time they shot you a dim light, you hit the button and you were rewarded for hitting the button when there was a light, you got one set of behavior. If you were punished, in other words, got a jelly bean taken away from you when you hit the button when there was not a light, you got a different behavior set. Basically, if you reward procedures, then in those gray zones where you're not quite sure what you should do, you're going to tend to go towards the procedure. This would relate to the use drug therapy or do an angioplasty on a person with chest pain and angina. Well, if it's rewarded to do the angioplasty and it's not really rewarded to do the medical therapy, then guess what happens? Same thing with the colonoscopy. If there's any doubt on whether or not you need to do a colonoscopy and there's no downside to doing another one, the risk to the patient is not considered in that equation. Maybe it should be, but generally isn't. Then you get more procedures. Those are perverse incentives. They need to be fixed. But the problem with the accountable care organization idea is it turns clinics into insurance agencies. And it's an attempt to fix the basic market issue of our healthcare system. In economic theory, the way a market works is that the person who's making the purchase is also paying the price, and therefore they will look for value, they will comparison shop, they will think twice before making a purchase decision. But in our economic healthcare system, the person making the purchase is the doctor, and the person paying the price is either the patient or the insurance company. The doctor has incentives to go towards procedures and go towards diagnostic studies because he or she could be sued if they didn't do the procedure. And there may, in fact, be actual financial reimbursement if, in fact, the procedure is something the doctor, him or herself, does. So the current protocol that is being proposed for the Accountable Care Organization is so bureaucratic and rule dense that it's going to have several unintended consequences. One of those is going to be to drive small groups and solo practitioners out of the business of primary care. You will need a large administrative staff to qualify to do primary care. Small offices will not be able to do that. They will have to either form alliances, if that's allowed, or become employees, which is kind of how this current regulation package is pushing things. The only option for a primary care doctor will become to either become an employee or to become a niche contractor, and there aren't enough niches for that. Competition for healthy patients will occur in these systems, so the clinics will now have their own set of perverse incentives for going after the healthy and trying to exclude the sick. Now, that is a very perverse way to run a healthcare system. Sick patients will become hot potatoes, and non-compliant patients or people who miss appointments or and have complex medical issues can expect to be terminated or kicked out of plans because they will be disincentivized. The people providing care for them will be disincentivized to provide that care. And again, when you have a gray zone situation, what you reward is where things head. So what would fix this? How do we set the incentives up? I have some thoughts about that. First of all, I think that for primary care, at least, doctors should receive fee for service, but not a high enough fee to encourage movement into that gray zone of doing unnecessary procedures. Secondly, in primary care practices, I think there should be a cap on the number of office visits and the number of enrolled patients. So you get fee for service, but you can't bring the patient in every week. Or if you do, you have to go to a special board of review to justify such frequent visits. And there should be a limit on the number of enrolled patients that a provider can have, because there's a limit to how many people you can take good care of, particularly if you're going to do preventative work. One of the tricks that's being used to try and work this is using surrogate markers, like the percentage of your patients that have had mammograms or the percentage of your diabetics that have had the diabetic blood test, the hemoglobin A1C, done in the last 12 months. That's not a bad strategy. Its current implementation, however, is very poor. And the way to make it work is, if you're going to use surrogate markers for quality, then you have to keep it secret which of the, let's say, 20 surrogate markers that you might use for quality that you're going to be doing. If you tell people in advance that, okay, percentage of mammograms is going to be what you get your bonus on this year, then everybody will have their mammograms that year, but maybe the emphasis won't be on the vaccinations or the colon cancer screening or whatever other surrogate markers for quality preventative care are being promoted at that particular time. So you kind of need to keep what you're going to get graded on a secret. It can't be an open book test. That would at least let offices know that if they worked hard on all of the surrogate markers, that would pay off. As it is, people are studying for the test. And believe me, as a recovering medical student, I know all about studying for the test. Let's go now to Rebecca in Capitola. Hello, Rebecca, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
I have a question about an abnormal blood test I had for my pancreas. I had a high amylase.
Okay. And, how high?
Not very high. I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers.
Okay, so like less than double the upper limit of normal.
I think so.
Okay, because you know they give you a 2 to 45 in the parentheses after the test. And okay, go ahead.
Doctor said it was slightly raised.
Slightly raised. Good. It's not double the upper limit of normal then.
I don't think so.
Now, did you have a lipase, L-I-P-A-S-E test as well?
Yes, I think so. It was a blunt test just to check my pancreas because I had some discomfort in that area. So we checked the pancreas.
Mm-hmm. If you have discomfort in that area, you also have discomfort in your duodenum and your stomach because the nerves that would cause right upper quadrant and or mid abdominal pain that radiates through the back could also be coming from those areas. Amylase being elevated alone can be due to inflammation of the GI tract. So in other words, a little duodenitis or inflammation of the small intestine could also give you an elevated amylase, but it won't give you an elevated lipase. The amylase test goes up, it's more sensitive, it goes up early in pancreatitis, but it also goes up from other things, things that are maybe a little bit more common than pancreatitis. Now, people who would get pancreatitis would be people who were drinking a lot or people who had gallstones, sometimes people with severe diabetes. Occasionally, pancreatitis can be due to drug toxicity, but that's actually quite rare. So do you have any risk factors like I've just mentioned?
I used to have gallstones. I haven't for years. Pancreatitis, I'm not sure. When I was a teenager, I drank on weekends, but not...
No, this would be current alcohol. Yeah.
I haven't had anything to drink for years.
Okay. So you have no diagnosis at this point. You do not have a diagnosis of pancreatitis with just a little bump in your amylase.
No, the doctor wanted to we checked for gluten because I wondered if I was gluten sensitive. I have problems eating wheat sometimes. My throat kind of swells up and it's hard to swallow it.
Well, don't eat wheat.
I haven't eaten wheat for a long time.
Yeah.
So
okay,
I don't have
good.
That problem. The doctor wanted to test gluten, have me eat wheat for a month. I said, I don't really want to do that.
No. And it's good that your doctor is aware, and I want to emphasize that detail. If a person is avoiding something because they think they're sensitive to it, then even if they are sensitive, the test will eventually go negative. And so that is the catch-22 of when people tell me, well, I can't eat wheat, but I have negative gluten testing. It's like, yeah, well, gluten testing's not that accurate. So the
I asked for the gene test. That came out negative for gluten.
No, what that came out with is you came out negative for the DQ2 and the DQ8, which means that you can't have celiac disease. You can still be sensitive to gluten. You can still be sensitive to wheat. You can be sensitive to these things without having those genes. You just won't get celiac disease without those genes.
Okay.
So sensitivity means you have antibodies to some component of wheat, if you're wheat sensitive. It doesn't have to be gluten. That's just one that's particularly nasty in terms of its ability to generate an antigenic response.
Okay, so I should pursue maybe just gluten or wheat sensitivity or gluten sensitivity instead of celiac?
Well, yeah. I mean, I would just do it empirically. Stop eating all wheat and gluten-containing products. Do that for 3 weeks. And if, presumably you have a symptom that you are worried about, then you re-challenge with that substance, and if the symptom occurs, then you can say, okay, well, I get that symptom from the substance.
Yeah, I have done that, and I don't eat. Why would my amylase be high? I'm so concerned about that.
There's half dozen reasons that the amylase could be high. Don't get too hooked into the blood test. Think about symptoms. Are you sick? How much pain are you in? How long have you been pain? I mean, those are the things that you'd need to tell me before I could give you any medical advice, which would be very generalized anyway due to the limitations of our situation.
Mm-hmm. So I've been having fatigue and dizziness, weakness. It's periodic. Fatigue is kind of ongoing unless it's a weekend when I'm not working. Makes sense? But I have had dizziness, which I'm concerned about. And that comes and goes.
Okay, so with fatigue and dizziness, food sensitivity wouldn't necessarily be the first thing I would go to in terms of explaining those symptoms. But gosh, I mean, then the list of things that could cause those symptoms is, it would take me the rest of the program just to recite the list. So I don't think you have gotten anything more than a red herring, a false clue from this elevated amylase.
Okay, so basically, if I'm functioning okay, then just it's not that important to pursue it.
Well, if you have an elevated amylase, and it's a little bit elevated, and you've got all of these generalized symptoms, it's probably not going to be even slightly useful to pursue the amylase. When I would pursue an elevated amylase would be if the lipase was also elevated, and then I would be going after imaging the pancreas, and I'd be looking for pancreatitis, and I'd be looking for gallstones, and I might do an ERCP, which is a test where you look for stones in the pancreatic duct. Those are all things that I would do as part of the medical workup if there were characteristic pancreatitis symptoms, and you can look those up, but they're vomiting and abdominal pain that radiates through to the back are primary symptoms, and you're not telling me these. So you don't sound like pancreatitis to me. If you don't have a lot of active abdominal pain, I wouldn't chase duodenitis. That hurts. And when every time you eat, a couple of hours later, you get a bad stomach ache. So if that's not the situation, you can chase this amylase down, but I don't think it'll get you any closer to treating dizziness and fatigue.
Okay, and CT scan, as the doctor recommended, to look for pancreatitis. Is that a lot of radiation? Is an MRI better if you were going to pursue this, to look further?
I think that a CT scan in the situation of someone with a mildly elevated amylase and a normal lipase and no symptoms suggestive of pancreatitis is not going to be positive for pancreatitis. So I would question whether or not the reason for this is just a medical legal rule out. So
I wondered about that.
And, I don't advocate taking a radiation dose for a medical legal rule out anymore. We've got alternatives. As far as an MRI is concerned, it's serious overkill. An ultrasound will actually give you information about active pancreatitis.
Okay.
But I don't think you have active pancreatitis. So clinically, based on what you've told me, I don't see an indication for additional studies. There may be information you haven't about your case that I'm not aware of. So I'm not telling you on the basis of a phone conversation not to get a study that your doctor's ordered. But I think it would be legitimate for you to ask your doctors what the specific justifications for a CT scan are, given that you are going to be taking a radiation dose that amounts to roughly 7 months of background radiation all at once.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I didn't want to go along with that. So that's why I'm calling you.
You can challenge them to justify it. And if it's, we want to make sure there's nothing wrong, what makes you think there is something wrong? And is it plausible? Or is it just to make sure? Make sure there's nothing wrong is usually code for I could get sued if we miss something.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Don. I appreciate your help.
By the way, you have to be the one to refuse the CT, and
I did refuse.
But yeah. I mean, in general, don't ask the doctor to violate the standard of care and give you permission not to do a test. You know what I'm saying? You can decide. You can say, okay, I hear what you're saying, doc, and it's fine for you to say that I refused the procedure and you told me that I could have cancer and I said I don't want it anyway. Let the doctor off the hook.
Oh, okay.
See, so in the chart it says, I recommended this study, the patient refused, it's fine. I'm off the hook. You can't sue me if you do turn out to have pancreatic cancer. Why you would sue me if you have pancreatic cancer anyway, given that it's an incurable cancer that is almost always lethal, and therefore I didn't give it to you, and it's not my fault you have it, and if you do have it, finding it doesn't save your life. You know what I'm saying? You see the line?
You're saying I should say thank you, but I don't want that. Test.
That's right. You should be kind to your doctor and say, can you what's the justification? And after you hear what the justification is, make an adult-informed decision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
I did that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And also, someone wanted me to remind the wheat avoiders out there that you must read labels because there is gluten in salad dressing, a lot of starch, cheap, bulks up things, tastes good. A lot of starch gets added to all kinds of things that you wouldn't expect, like pudding. Let's go to Margaret in Santa Cruz. Margaret, our time is short, but I wanted to try to get your call in.
Right. Hello, Dr. Don.
Hello.
I'm a 75-year-old woman. I live in Santa Cruz. I eat organically, don't do junk food, fast food, etc. Do not do any NSAIDs. Last fall, I had 2 episodes of severe upper abdominal pain, and they were accompanied by, they were at a two-week interval and accompanied by moderate abdominal pain. At that time, I had an ultrasound, an MRCP, and an endoscopy. The endoscopy showed mild inflammation of the stomach, which the GI man said was nothing to worry about, and a little bit of tissue sloughing off in the esophagus, and he said that was also not abnormal. And by the time I saw him for the endoscopy, my pain was gone. This week, I returned to my family practice doc because I had a recurrence of upper abdominal pain. For the very first time in my presence, he looked at the biopsy results that had been taken by the gastroenterologist,
mm-hmm.
which show, first of all, no Helicobacter pylori, and I don't take any NSAIDs. Okay, for the stomach, reactive gastropathy is an entity associated with use of nonsteroidal...
Okay, you don't need to read it. So you had reactive gastropathy as the...
Yes, and also in the esophagus, consistent mm-hmm. with reflux esophagitis.
Right.
I've never had heartburn.
Right.
How did this happen?
You had heartburn and you didn't feel it. And so acid got up into the esophagus and burned it, possibly also bile acid, because some people will have bile that will actually leak into their stomach and then leak into their esophagus. And it often happens in overnight in your sleep. People may be having reflux for years before they actually develop heartburn while awake. When you lie down at night, your stomach is uphill from your esophagus.
Yes.
And you know, as you get older, things get looser and floppier
mm-hmm.
and start to leak. And so your lower esophageal sphincter is leaking.
Mm-hmm.
You may also have poorer blood flow to the region, so it's harder for it to heal. You may have reduced mucus production. You may have reduced acid production, which goes along with reduced mucus production. But paradoxically, the loss of the mucus is greater than the loss of the acid, so the reduced acid you've got still causes a burn.
Oh, and I have a small hiatal hernia.
And the hiatal hernia is a huge risk factor
okay.
for having this problem.
Okay.
So you go to my website, askdrdon.com,
right.
go to resources.
Okay.
There's a series of helpful hints to avoid reflux.
Okay.
Follow them all, including okay. jacking up the head of the bed. That's probably one of the most important things
okay.
for you to do.
Yeah, I've been on a proton pump inhibitor since this week, and the pain has gone.
That's good, but you don't want to be on a proton pump inhibitor forever because it will tend to trigger osteoporosis
right.
and B12 deficiency.
All right.
So we got to go.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Ask Dr. Don. Another hour has gone by so quickly. I'll see you next week. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.